I shall not be, I shall not be moved, because God can't see me. I can get away with whatever.
I don't think that's what that song was about. But. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to the Bible Geeks Weekly Podcast. This is episode 49. I'm Brian Sheely.
I'm Ryan Joy.
And thanks so much, everyone, for tuning in. If you listened to last week's episode, this one is going to sound pretty much the same. This is episode 48, part 2. Welcome to episode 49.
I don't know if that sounds exciting. Like, just go back and listen to the last one again.
We're continuing in our Into the Book Bible reading program with week 4, and that's Luke 16 through 20. Also, we're getting into the second psalm right after Psalm 9, now Psalm 10, and we're going to be talking on this episode about praising God even in challenging times, which I think a lot of this Psalm 10 really deals with.
And we read this psalm on Monday, so yeah, we don't often sync up with our psalms because we're going to be on Psalm 150 and in our reading plan and be on Psalm like 13 in our Poetry in Motion series.
So as we've been doing these last few episodes, starting off the episode with a segment that we call Finding Jesus. And so we're in Luke chapter 16 through 20. What here jumps out at you in this reading this week?
There were so many things, and I decided to just grab onto this little verse that I thought was just cool in its simplicity. It's in Luke 19, verse 48, which is today, Thursday's reading. And it says, talking about the scribes and the Pharisees and everybody that's trying to find something to attack Jesus with and make him look bad, it says, but they did not find anything they could do, for all the people were hanging on his words. I love that phrase, the people were hanging on his words. Like, wouldn't you be? You read these words in the book of Luke and you're just like, oh, tell me more about that. And you just want to hear what else he has to say. But both his enemies and the common folks, everybody is seeing his authority in his words. And they keep trying to trap him, and everything they throw at him. Chapter 20 is full of things they're trying to snare and capture him with these tricky questions. And everything he throws back at them is so brilliant. Mm-hmm. I have said before that if Jesus didn't do wonderful miracles and all we had was his words to go on, his words alone show you something really special about who he was, and I think reveal him to be the Christ, because anybody could have said these things, but nobody else would have, not without this game-changing teaching that Jesus brings and kind of shifts the nature of all of our thinking.
Yeah. It reminds me of, you know, that cat poster with the cat hanging from the rope or whatever that says hang in there.
Yeah.
That's what this reminds me of. It's definitely something that he has captivated them with. Not only, like you said, with his miracles, but his teachings. Mm-hmm. And just the frankness and the way that he responds to opposition to these Pharisees, mm-hmm. there's nothing like it. And I think one of the benefits, too, in this reading plan of reading through Luke as quickly as we have, it wasn't very long ago that we were seeing a 12-year-old Jesus in the temple, and everyone was just marveling at how knowledgeable he was, even in his youth.
Yes.
And you see that never changing throughout his ministry. There was never a time where people were like, okay, Jesus, this is super boring. I mean, so a lot of times they didn't understand what he was saying, but the way that he spoke to them was certainly compelling.
That is a great point. Jesus is never boring. It's, how many people can you say that about? It's not about us.
Certainly not me.
I don't understand how anyone could open up and start reading some of the red letters in any of the Gospels and not be fascinated and wonder, what does that mean? And mm-hmm. what else is he going to say? That's a great point. So what was your insight about who Jesus is?
Yeah, so I find it super interesting in Luke 17. We learn a little story about Jesus that makes him seem really relatable to me as a parent. In Luke 17, verses 15, a little bit lengthy reading, but it says, then one of them, this is a reference to these 10 lepers that Jesus heals. It says, then one of them, when he saw that he was healed, mm-hmm. turned back, praising God with a loud voice, and he fell on his face at Jesus' feet, giving him thanks. Now he was a Samaritan. Then Jesus answered, were not 10 cleansed? Where are the 9? Was no one found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner? And he said to him, rise and go your way. Your faith has made you well. What strikes me in this is the response that Jesus gives is a lot of the way that I respond to my daughter or to maybe other people that I help and do kind, generous things for, who don't turn around and express appreciation for what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus is basically saying, I want you to be grateful for what I'm doing. And I think this is maybe one of the only times we see that after a miracle that he's performed, almost putting it out there like, I expect you to be grateful for this. And I don't think he would have ever said it or made a mention of it had this Samaritan leper turned around and came back to thank him and praise God at his feet. And he uses this moment basically to say, you need to be grateful, and praises this man for being grateful. But then with sort of a sadness, and you see that kind of in his words, this disappointment that he has, that the other 9 lepers just went on their way and they were so consumed in their own healing that they forgot to come back and say thank you to Jesus for what he had done for them.
It's interesting the way this story plays out, that Jesus doesn't say you're healed. He says, go and show yourself to the priest.
Yes.
And right. as they went, they were cleansed. So you can make the case for all the ways it would be so easy for them not to come back and say thank you. And
well, he did tell them to leave.
Exactly. They're following his commandment. They're doing, right. he didn't say go and when you see something, come back. In a way, they're being more faithful to the Lord's command than this Samaritan that turns around and comes mm-hmm. back. But we are meant to have a certain kind of attitude that draws us to God to say, may you be praised. May you be thanked for what you've done. And this guy fell at Jesus' feet. No one is supposed to be worshiped on hands and knees, but God, and Jesus accepts that. There's a finding Jesus right there. But yeah, and they're just going to follow Jesus' command, but also they are maybe halfway to Jerusalem at this point. You know, who knows at what point they were on this journey or which priests they're going to see. And so they could be, you know, way down the road whenever this happens. And it just, I guess, just emphasizes your point that it's never a bad time to interrupt whatever you're doing to give God thanks.
Yeah.
Whenever something good happens, you know who it's from, who the source is. Stop what you're doing and give thanks.
Well, and another point of connection here with what you're saying is the fact that it says that he came back and he thanked Jesus, but he was praising God.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, it doesn't come right out and say this, but in a sense, he's acknowledging that Jesus did this by God's power and God's authority. Jesus mm-hmm. and God were hand in hand in this miracle. They were working together in this. And it reminds me a lot of the blind man as he answered the Pharisees in John chapter 9, when he says to them almost kind of in a snarky way, if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And I think that's what this Samaritan is recognizing here,
mm-hmm.
that Jesus is doing this because he is God's messenger.
Right.
He is God's chosen one, really.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah. So let's get into our second segment, which is scripture du jour.
What is the soup du jour?
It's the soup of the day.
Mm, that sounds good. I'll have that.
So today we are in Luke chapter 19 in our reading plan here. And what in this chapter jumps out at you, something that you found really important in our walk with the Lord?
It was very striking to me to see this contrast that happens. You know, we've been building towards Jerusalem. This whole section going back to chapter 9, verse 51, when he turns his face toward Jerusalem, we're getting closer and closer. And every time you take a step closer, Luke has started to plant these pins on the map, mm-hmm. and he plants more and more location pins telling you where Jesus is as you get closer in chapter 18. Chapter 19 has a bunch of them. And then finally, he comes, and the people, the multitude of his disciples, have one response as he's marching in to Jerusalem. But Jesus, I don't know why, I never caught this before, at that moment seems to have a very different response. So verses 37 to 41 of today's reading, chapter 19, as he was drawing near, already on the way down the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of his disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest." And this is what everybody's saying. They're just shouting, "Blessed is the King, mm-hmm. blessed." And some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." He answered, "I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out." And when he drew near and saw the city, he wept over it. Everybody's praising him. There's joy, glory to God in the highest. He's coming in on the donkey. He's has this air of celebration. The king has come. Mm-hmm. But his response is different because he knows what's coming. And he's been telling the disciples back in chapter 18, he told them again a third time that he was going to be handed into the hands of men, but it was concealed from them all that that meant. And so Jesus is lamenting over Jerusalem. He's lamenting over their rejection of him. He wanted them to be blessed. And they're not going to be. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that contrast that Jesus is always carrying with him, this knowledge in every moment of joy, this knowledge of what's to come as well. His whole life must have been sort of bittersweet because he could see the glory also better than we could. But he sees all of the rejection, all of the disappointment, the people who are going to make bad choices, and his own suffering that's to come.
Yeah, I'm going to continue that with mine because I essentially picked verses 41 and 42 of this reading. I think it's super important even to continue this because, as you just read, "And when he drew near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes." And then he's going to go on to talk about the upcoming destruction, really, of Jerusalem and what's going to happen to the city.
Yeah.
But the fact that as he gets closer and closer to Jerusalem, and even in the midst of all of this celebration and all of the praise and glory that he's being given from all the people, he's sad about it. He's admitted, I mean, there's no reason why he wouldn't be sad about this because he knows in just a few short days what's going to happen. But I think the other piece of this, like you touched on, is the fact that he knows that they, as God's chosen people, should have known who he was. He says, "You, even you."
That hurts.
You can feel it. Like you, yeah. It's just he's agonizing over the fact that they should have known him. They should have accepted him. And if Jerusalem didn't know who Jesus was, if Jerusalem wasn't willing to acknowledge who Jesus was, then who in the world would have? They're the people who God chose to bring Jesus into the world through.
Yeah.
And they were the ones who had the best shot of knowing who he was, but they're the very ones who were going to reject him. And I think it's just shows this hardness of their heart that they had. It kind of reminds me of Pharaoh and a lot of the other people like Saul and people throughout the Bible history who just had hard hearts. And Isaiah prophesied about this in Isaiah chapter 6, verse 10, that basically they were going to have eyes, but they weren't going to see, and they were going to have ears, but they weren't going to hear. And they were the ones who should have known better. And Jesus is really just agonizing about the fact that they don't see him. They don't understand who he is. Eventually they will, or at least some of them, hopefully.
Well, and a critical thing that they didn't see, he says in verse 44, "Because you did not know the time of your visitation."
Yeah.
I think that's a really important word, your visitation. That's the word there is episcopate, related to the word for overseer of a church, a a bishop and a, you know, someone who's an overseer, but it has to do with God coming in either salvation or judgment, but God drawing near as a time of visitation. God has come in Jesus. Their king that they've all been waiting for is here, and they're not recognizing it. And I think back in like chapter 2 in the prophecies and all the songs that were talked about, this idea is that they have, of course, God knew they were going to, but they have missed the time of visitation. And so they are going to see God's judgment 30 some years later. Jerusalem will, there will be a complete and final end to the special place of the earthly Jerusalem for the Lord as the temple of the Lord and the presence of God, and the special place of Judaism comes to a utter cleansing. You know, the next verse right after this, the next section is Jesus cleansing the temple. You've made my house
den of thieves.
A den of thieves. This is a place where evildoers come in, and he cleanses it. Well, an ultimate cleansing of the temple is going to come in 70 AD. And it's because, as you said, they didn't know the things that make for peace. They didn't know the time of God's visitation on them.
Yeah. And I think an application that I take away from this too, for me, is there's a lot of times where you and I both know people. I'm sure we all know people who leave the Lord, who should know better. Kind of that 2 Peter 2 verse 20 idea where they just wandered away. And we know people like that. And we've experienced those kinds of sad moments where we've seen people walk away from their faith. And am I as touched by those people leaving the Lord as Jesus is for Jerusalem, who should have known better? I don't know. Sometimes it's easy just out of sight, out of mind, kind of to forget about those people or to stop thinking about them as much as we could or should. But I think Jesus here shows us a great lesson in, you know, no matter what's going on, even though you might know that somebody is going to walk away, if you can see it on the horizon, if you can kind of get a picture, maybe you've seen them start to wander away and you've tried to bring them back and you've tried to encourage them, but they just keep going further and further and further away. It doesn't change the fact that that should be deeply impactful for us. We should sincerely desire that those people come back, just like Jesus over this city is weeping over them, that he wants them to come back. He wants them to come to their senses.
Yeah, it makes me think of Paul, another kinsman of Jesus, according to the flesh, another Jew that loved Jerusalem, loved his people. And he said, I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish. I would that I were accursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my brothers, my kinsmen according to the flesh, in Romans 9. And Jesus truly was cursed. Cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. Cursed for his brothers because he loved all of us so much.
Yeah,
that's a great question. Do we weep in the same way?
Well, that's Luke chapter 19. So let's get into our third and final segment. And you guessed it, it's poetry in motion. Poetry
in motion. She blinded me with science. But
she did, for sure. So we're in Psalm 10, and this is a continuation, as you mentioned last week, of the acrostic psalms started in Psalm 9. Interestingly, in the Septuagint, as we talked about before, this is included right in the numbering with Psalm 9. So seems fitting just to roll right into it and continue talking about it.
Yeah, I think that it's good that they're separate, even though they're related, like two sides of a coin, because it really is a dramatic shift from where we were at the end of Psalm 9 to Psalm 10. You see a lot of echoing and a lot of the things go together, but now he starts off with this, rather than praise, with lament. Why? Why is really the key word here. Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide in times of trouble? And the message, which is a paraphrase that I think sometimes is interesting to read on the Psalms, not the place to go if you're looking for something totally faithful to the text, but sometimes it's a good change of pace to think of a perspective on it. And the message starts out, God, are you avoiding me? Where are you when I need you? Yeah. Sometimes you feel that way. Sometimes you feel like asking why. Sometimes you feel like God has distanced himself when you look at the things happening and your prayers don't seem like they're being heard. And there's these times of trouble, and yet it felt like God was with you in all the good times, but now in times of trouble, he's gone. And so the point of this section, I think, is why do you let these evil people get away with this stuff? There's a song we sing called Farther Along that brings up this same kind of thing. Why do people seem to get away with things while good people are suffering? And so after asking why, in verse 1, verses 2 through 4, he talks about what these people do and what they think. And it's not a pretty sight. He talks about how they pursue the poor, how they boast of getting everything they want. And in verse 4, it says, in the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. Mm-hmm. If there were a God, I wouldn't be able to do whatever I want. Those people that are trying to do the right thing wouldn't be falling apart over there. If you just read these four verses, it would be pretty depressing if that was what we had as a revealed message from God. But when God seems distant and the wicked are winning, here's the application. Read the rest of the psalm. You've got to keep reading. And sometimes in our life, it's like we get stuck in the first few verses of a psalm and we have to keep reading to the end of the psalm, literally and figuratively, understand that there's more to the story. So, how does he go on to describe these wicked men?
If last week he was talking about these wicked people in Psalm 9, Psalm 10, he just goes into graphic detail. Mm. If you want to know who these people really are, he goes into it here. And in the first verse here in verse 5, basically he calls them prosperous people, which is kind of a weird thing to think about. He says that in his ways, at all times, he prospers. Your judgments are on high, out of his sight. As for all his foes, he puffs at them. So I've kind of termed these the prosperous but prideful puffers.
Very alliterative.
Yeah. They are doing well. They're successful, but they're forgetful of God's judgment. It's like God is above them and they can't see up high enough to see that God is there. And the fact is, they, in verse 6, he describes them as stubborn and trouble-free. They're just living their lives, telling themselves that they're always going to be successful, that nothing is ever going to happen that's negative to them, and that they're just so stubborn they can't see really what's going on, what the reality of the situation is. He talks about in verse 7 how they have lips of a troublemaker, that they spew out of their mouths these terrible kinds of words, and he's very descriptive about the kinds of things that they say. Mm. And in verses 8 through 10, he talks about how they are oppressing the poor, and that's something we touched on in the last psalm. Mm-hmm. How seriously they are out to get and out to take advantage of the poor. It says in verse 8, he sits in ambush in the villages, in hiding places, he murders the innocent. That's graphic detail right there. These are people who are just really seriously taking advantage of the innocent and the poor. And in verse 11, he talks about how they've so convinced themselves that God has forgotten, that he has hidden his face. He will never see it. That's what they tell themselves, that God doesn't see what they're doing. God's not really there. And so the key verse here, I think, is in verse 6 for me. He says in his heart, I shall not be moved. Throughout all generations, I shall not meet adversity.
I hope that's not the genesis of the psalm, the hymn that we sing. I shall not be moved. Because God can't see me. I can get away with whatever.
I don't think that's what that song was about.
That would probably be a misinterpretation.
No, yeah, for sure. But this is what they're saying to themselves. And you can just see how stubborn they are. And here's the thing. I mean, the word he uses is he and his all the time here in this section. Really, it's just highlighting the fact that these people are really terrible people. And of the two things that these, as I'm calling them, prosperous but prideful puffers say to themselves.
You just want to say that a bunch of times, don't
I love
you?
It. I have
Can you
to,
say it five times fast?
I don't think so. No, I will not try. But of the two things that he records that they're saying about themselves, both of these things are things that we easily can say to ourselves today. Nothing bad is going to happen to me, and God isn't going to notice. Mm-hmm. And as much as I read this and I think, man, these are terrible, terrible people, we get back into the conversation we had last week about those people. And mm-hmm. I can see myself in this.
Me too.
Sometimes.
Absolutely.
I mean, I can see that there are times where I don't see that God is just outside of my sight and his judgment is always there. And I can see myself saying nothing bad is going to happen. God isn't going to notice, and he's not seeing what I'm doing. And as challenging as these verses are, I think if you can hear yourself saying the kinds of things that they're saying, then maybe you have a little bit more sympathy for these people. Maybe it helps wake you up as much as it wakes me up in reading this.
Yeah, that's hopefully some of these other things about these guys does not describe us.
Yes.
Going after the poor and
verses 8 through 10 hopefully is never something that we're guilty of, but you're not so far off when you find yourself thinking these same things.
Yeah, you have this idea, well, lightning's not going to strike me, out of sight, out of mind, and I'm going to do my best, but you know, it's everything is so distant. Yeah, absolutely. That's I was thinking the same thing.
So as David then sees these people and their wickedness, what does he turn to God and pray about and ask for?
To sum it up in a couple of words, he basically asks, do something. Do something, God. He says, arise, O Lord, lift up your hand, do something. And so that's verse 12. And then why do they think they'll get away with it is kind of the question in verse 13. And then in verse 14, he says, but you do see what's happening. And so in verse 15, again, do something. He specifically says, break their arm, which is pretty intense, the arm of the wicked. So the key verse here for me is verse 14. It says, but you do see, for you note mischief and vexation, that you may take it into your hands. To you, the helpless commits himself. You have been the helper of the fatherless. So a few key words in there. We've seen this word, why. He keeps asking why. Why do the wicked renounce God back in the verse before this? But it goes back and connects this whole story in Psalm 10. But also this statement that God does see, to me, this connects it back to David's prayer in the previous psalm that I talked about in Psalm 9, verse 13, see my affliction from those who hate me. And so here he says, you see the wicked, you see me, you see the helpless, you see everything that's happening, and you will do something.
It's a contrast with what they're saying, right? You don't see me, God.
Exactly, exactly.
And he says, I'm an open book. You see me.
Yeah. You see right through me. You see everything that happens. And the key word that I grabbed onto, even though it's only used once, is this word helpless. To you, the helpless commits himself. I love that. I love that because you have been the helper of the fatherless. To you, the helpless commits himself. Mm-hmm. Even in the midst of it seeming like the wicked are getting away with things, they're oppressing. Where else are we going to turn? Where else is the helpless going to turn? And when you feel most helpless, we have to remember that helping the helpless is God's specialty.
Yeah.
That's what he has always done. That's what we keep reading about in Luke, that he keeps flipping the tables upside down, literally.
Literally, yeah.
Literally. But throughout the book of Luke, it's amazing how much that theme has been reinforced, that Jesus is just out to deliver the weakest people. Not that he isn't seeking everybody. He goes after the rich. Sometimes those are the outcasts that are most forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
But the humble of heart and those who have been poor in spirit and lowly are the ones that are available to God and that he can be counted on to deliver and help.
That's what we saw with Jesus and those 10 lepers, too. I mean,
yes.
Of all the people who society had rejected, people who had leprosy were probably the most rejected people of all. Like, you didn't want to have anything to do with them.
They couldn't even come close to Jesus. They were standing afar, it said, shouting out, "Have mercy on us,
exactly,
son of David."
Exactly. And there were times where even Jesus would touch those lepers that he healed, which is, I mean, that's just an abomination. Like, you don't do that. Mm-hmm. And Jesus was there to offer this kind of help for even the most helpless among them, which I think is
there
great.
There might be a episode in Jesus and touch. It's a really interesting thing, that that whole theme of Jesus touching people, touching the untouchable. So how does he close out this psalm?
In verses 16 through 18 of Psalm 10, basically he kicks this thing off with verse 16, "The Lord is king forever and ever. The nations perish from his land." And I think that's the key verse here, that you could probably just sum up this whole Psalm 9 and 10 combo with acknowledging the fact that the Lord is on his throne, he is reigning, he is king, and the nations around, these wicked people, all the people who are against God, they're going to perish from the land.
And what a difference that is from where we started. Again, that's why you have to keep reading to the end. That is the opposite of where the psalmist starts this story.
Yeah, exactly. And verses 17 through 18 finish it off by saying that he is a God who listens. And as we just talked about, he's a God who helps the oppressed, but he brings an end to man's terror. He is on the side of those who need him, of the afflicted, of those who are fatherless and oppressed. He's doing justice for them. He's strengthening their hearts. He's listening and inclining his ears to them. But he says at the end, "So that man who is of the earth may strike terror no more. For as much terrible things as man can do, God is on his throne and is going to enact justice against people who are terrifying, really, his people. And so he's going to take care of them because he listens and he is on their side." It's just a great thought to close this thing out with.
Oh, man, that is so great. Why is God's judgment so important? People don't like to hear about God's judgment. Why is so God's judgment so important? To do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed, so that man who is of the earth may strike terror no more. No more terror.
As I think about this, I'm thinking, if the king is listening, you know, what am I really asking? What am I asking for? Am I bringing God all of my concerns? Or do I think that something is too trivial to bring to God? If he is really listening, as this psalm is talking about, then I should be willing to bring him everything I have, anything that's going on, and nothing is off the table because he's listening. And David acknowledges that. We see that in Luke as we've been reading, how Jesus cares about even the smallest of problems and issues that are going on. And we have that kind of confidence to know that not only is he listening, but he has the power to make those things work out for good for those who love him. And if we come to him boldly when we're going through difficult times, when trouble comes up, then we can be assured that he is going to be on our side to help us.
Well, in yesterday's readings in chapter 18 of Luke, you saw this issue come to the forefront with two stories about prayer and what we're asking for God. And then you see the rich young ruler who has to figure out what he really wants. And then Jesus actually asks this blind man, "What do you want me to do for you?" So it emphasizes this thing that you're saying. What am I asking of this God who is inclining his ear toward me? What do I want to ask? What do you want me to do for you?
All right. So let's close this thing out. What is our challenge for this week? I think it's going to probably tie into a lot of the things we've been talking about here.
Absolutely. You see this psalmist really pouring his heart out and speaking very frankly to God. Why are you doing this? Why are you letting people prosper in their wickedness? And sometimes I think we can become so careful in our prayers that we don't really talk to God. And you can honor God as God. And if you start to forget who he is, you'll get back there, as the psalmist does, in praise. But the challenge is for this week, speak your mind to God in prayer.
I think that's super important. You read this psalm as he opens up in verse 1. Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? Mm-hmm. I don't know, honestly, if I would have that kind of confidence to say that to God. But yeah. When I'm saying it from the perspective of David with respect and fear, if it's what I'm thinking, then really, I don't think we should be afraid to ask God those questions. Not that David is trying to accuse God of anything, but I think David is genuinely trying to understand, why are these things happening? Why do you allow bad things to happen? Where are you? And in that kind of sense of being honest and genuine, God doesn't need us to put on a front.
No.
He knows what's going on.
He seeks our honesty, and we should be able to say, I am angry, God, and I don't understand why you're doing this. Mm-hmm. David calls him Yahweh right there in that sentence, in the first sentence. Why, O Yahweh, do you stand far away? He's not forgetting who he is, right. But he's just trying to talk to the one king who can do anything about it and speak honestly about it.
Well, I think that's really good. All right, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning into the Bible Geeks podcast. You can find us on our website at BibleGeeks.fm. You can find show notes for this episode at BibleGeeks.fm/49. You can also follow along with our daily download series. That's at BibleGeeks.fm/daily. And if you haven't checked out our Into the Book reading program, that is at BibleGeeks.fm/Into the Book. We are also on social media. Come along, find us, join in the conversation, and get in touch with us. If you have any questions, or if you'd like to hear us talk about anything on the show, we'd love to entertain those and get into those topics. And until next week, everyone, may the Lord bless you and keep you.
Shalom.